I think that we can use this Core Exit product in the areas where the beaches are active, the water is active, and it will do not nearly as much damage as we probably are washing the beaches heavily.
If it really is Exxon's position that an effective response cannot be safely maintained during the winter months, then what does that say about the transport of oil in Prince William Sound or in other parts of the Alaskan environment during those same months?
Will we get it all done? Probably not. There will be some areas that we won't be able to get to, would be my judgment right now. And one of the major reasons for that is that this oil is very tenacious. It hangs onto the rocks and the shorelines as if it doesn't want to leave.
That's only because it's through. We've only discontinued in places where the beach is done. We're still working very actively there.
Murkowski says the idea is to prevent another oil spill disaster like the Exxon Valdez, and he argues that local citizen advisory councils can do that. The councils, to be funded under a $3 million pilot program, would be composed of local fishermen, natives, business people, and sportsmen. The councils will hire scientific and technical experts to monitor the environment and look at new technology to prevent future spills. In the wake of other oil spills in Rhode Island, Delaware, and Texas, Murkowski defended on the Senate floor putting the councils in Alaska.
Don't forget that approximately 25% of the crude oil that's produced in the United States today comes from my state of Alaska. And as a consequence, we feel that we should have a proportional share in the expertise that's being developed to ensure that we don't have accidents such as this occur again.
Murkowski says he got the idea for the amendment from a couple of Cordova fishermen who heard about a citizens' advisory council at an oil terminal in Scotland. He says the concept is to improve relations between the industry and local citizens.
It puts local citizens, the oversight of terminal operations at the Valdez and Kenai areas, working in a partnership in the oversight of contingency and containment plans, is designed to reestablish credibility between the industry and Alaskans.
Local monitoring and oil spill committees would report to the advisory councils at Valdez and Kenai. The councils would then make recommendations on policies, permits, and regulations affecting the terminals. A state federal industry panel would make final decisions. Murkowski says the proposal addresses a key element of the Exxon Valdez disaster.
That accident was the direct result of complacency by industry, state, and federal regulators. Enough blame for everybody. With local citizens monitoring terminal activities in the future, we'll hopefully prevent a disaster such as we had and rebuild a partnership based on trust.
Regulators and industry may grow complacent over time, but Murkowski says the people whose way of life depends on the environmentally safe operation of the terminals will not. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Fred Burns in Washington, D.C.
We believe that we have set up a procedure whereby we are going to have more double bottoms and hulls in the world than if we just mandated our own. There aren't that many tankers being built in the United States anymore.
Just before Harrison made his remark, the state's environmental commissioner, Dennis Kelso, was telling the Oil Spill Commission how Exxon's cleanup has not been as fully developed in the Gulf of Alaska as it is in Prince William Sound. Kelso said even though the oiling is lighter in the Gulf, the damage is just as severe.
For a fisherman who lives in Kodiak, it doesn't much matter whether it's 2% of the shoreline that's heavily oiled. If that fisherman gets two tar balls in his seine and isn't able to fish, that's where the damage is. It isn't that we're suggesting that the shoreline looks the way it does in Prince William Sound, but that the consequences are equally important, and that's why it's so critical to have a fully developed effort.
Kelso's statement prompted Exxon's Otto Harrison to respond.
If you look at the zero tolerance plan, is a joint decision by Alaska Fish and Game and ADEC, that's a marketing decision and that's not an environmental decision. And in fact, you had Prince William Sound shut in this week or this past week that had, for a reason that had nothing to do with the oil spill. It had to do with a zero tolerance program and in the oil that was involved, where there was oil involved, happened to be diesel or hydraulic or other fuels and had nothing to do with it. So I think there is another area for the fishermen to be concerned with in these communities, and they are concerned, and we share their concern, about whether that zero tolerance policy, that economic policy, is a correct and valid way to be proceeding. And I think that's entirely independent and a separate decision relative to how we clean up the oil spill.
Harrison barely had the words out of his mouth when one of the oil spill commissioners, John Sun, jumped in.
Well, I totally disagree. I'm going to take this one head on. I'm a fisherman. I have a fish processing company. And that is an absolutely irresponsible comment. And I'd like Exxon to withdraw it. Right now.
Well, Commissioner, I'm sorry. I don't know what you're describing as irresponsible.
The fact that the state of Alaska has made a decision not to put oiled fish into the world economy because Exxon dumped 11 million gallons of oil in the water. It's Exxon's
zero
problem.
Tolerance policy doesn't have anything to do with whether you put oil fish into the market. It has to do with when you do or don't fish. There were facilities capable that would have handled contaminated fish. Again, that's a separate issue from this. Those facilities were available. Test fishing has been made available. And those were all that. We did not take full advantage of that in the system.
DEC Commissioner Kelso defended the state's policy, saying consumers had to be assured no oil fish would make it to market. And the first line of defense is to make sure no contaminated fish are caught. Kelso said there's no way to separate the economic considerations from the issue of seafood safety, and given the volume of the oil and the hundreds of miles of contaminated shoreline, there was no way to have enough inspectors. Harrison said Exxon offered to supply more inspectors. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
17 dead California gray whales have been found so far this season in the Gulf of Alaska. The National Marine Fisheries Service says that's more deaths than have been reported in other years. But the deputy director of the Fisheries Service in Alaska, Jim Brooks, says he doesn't know yet if the oil spill is to blame for any of the whale deaths.
To be frank with you, I simply can't tell you at this time whether or not any of them were affected by the oil. We know that most of them were not, but we can't say that with certainty on all of them.
Brooks says the Fisheries Service has pulled tissue samples from a couple of the whale carcasses, but those samples are still undergoing tests, and it could be several more weeks before the results are back. Biologists, however, have been able to rule out oil contamination in many of the deaths. Brooks says several of the whales were so badly decomposed that it's clear they died before the oil spill, and at least one whale died after tangling itself in fishing nets. Still, there has been an increase in sightings of dead whales, even though Brooks says one of the reasons may simply be that there are just more people paying attention to how Alaska's marine life is faring this year.
There is better reporting this year. There are so many people out and so many people sensitive to the possible adverse effects of oil on wild things. Any time a person sees something dead now, we get a call.
While the 17 whale deaths do sound like a lot, Brooks also points out that between 18 and 20,000 California grays migrate to Alaska waters each year. Though authorities say they can't yet prove why some of the whales are dying, the lack of information is causing concern among some Kodiak area residents who say they want to know what's going on. Charlene Parent has more from Kodiak.
At Friday's oil spill meeting, Clark Peltz of the Department of Environmental Conservation said DEC crews recently discovered 9 dead whales on Tagetik Island alone. Tagetik lies just south of Kodiak.
There is a couple of people that live on the island year-round. They've been there for 3 years. They told our DEC crews that on an average year, they find 2 to 3 dead whales on their island. Usually it's up in their lagoon. The whales get in there to breed, and the tide goes out. And the woman claimed that she had seen 2 of the whales that are on her island now had oil in the baleen.
Peltz said DEC would keep the public informed if crews came upon any more fresh carcasses. But the public will not be informed when test results on the whales come in. There's a gag order on the National Marine Fisheries Service because evidence gathered on the whales may someday be used against Exxon in litigation. Many Kodiak residents, like Dolly Reft, resent being kept in the dark. Reft says subsistence users are already nervous about contamination of the wildlife. The unusual number of whales found washed up just magnifies their concern.
We are having to be at the mercy of the decisions and the facts you allow us to receive. Now, as a native person from this area, these whales are indicative as to what is happening in our environment and is not due to the traffic out there. I've gotten 6 phone calls of people crying on the phone asking what they can do and what they're supposed to do, and they've already ingested the food from the environment. When they see the whales dying, they've tried to be calm about the carcasses they picked up, but they're starting to fear now for ingesting the food.
Despite what the public may feel as their right to know, it's doubtful the gag order would be lifted because any statements or information released by the scientists could be used against the government in court. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
On July 31st, Dan Lawn received a memo informing him that he was being removed from supervision of the Valdez office the following day. For the past 7 years, Lawn had served on Alaska's environmental front lines, criticizing Alyeska's air and water pollution performance and warning of the oil spill catastrophe that was waiting to happen if the state didn't get tougher with the consortium. 4 months after that catastrophe finally happened, Lawn found himself abruptly pulled off the Alyeska beat with no explanation. The DEC official responsible for the change, Division Director Larry Dietrich, said Wednesday that the move would allow Lawn to focus on the important area of oil spill contingency plans. Supervision of Alyeska was left to an official in Anchorage, Bruce Erickson. Although Lawn has had several run-ins with Alyeska officials and security guards over the years, leading Alyeska to brand the aggressive DEC watchdog a troublemaker, Dietrich and other DEC officials deny there was any oil industry pressure to get rid of Lawn. The Alaska Public Employees Association launched an investigation into the personnel action and has filed a grievance charging that the change is in effect a demotion without just cause. The grievance states that Lawn will suffer economic and professional harm and was not afforded due process. DEC officials declined to discuss the case, citing state personnel rules and the fact that the action was the subject of an employee grievance. Lawn himself refuses to discuss the issue, directing reporters to his union representative. APEA's Bob Watts says the union believes DEC is attempting something known in labor circles as constructive discharge. In effect, putting an employee in a position where he or she feels compelled to resign. Watts also says DEC is using stall tactics on Lawn, the union, and the media by refusing to disclose documents relating to the job action. DEC personnel officer Alan Hansen says reporters need to get privacy waivers not only from Lawn, but others that he says are named in the documents. Hansen says other restrictions may also apply because the documents may be the subject of a grievance. Watts says that's a smokescreen. He says DEC's actions are the subject of the grievance, not the documents. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
All of the news that's come out in the last week or so would indicate that we won't see much of Exxon next year. So someone has to pick it up and is going to have to go in there and clean those beaches up, run some skimmers, do some things that are going to be an ongoing process for the next 4 or 5 years. We were lucky this time that Exxon had the financial ability to respond to this, but we have other groups that are coming into our waters that do not have the financial ability. If they had a major spill such as this, they would have walked away, and there just would not have been enough money to have funded the cleanup. If they put one of their boats on a rock, would they? Then they probably would just walk away, very much like the, I think it was the Libyan tanker that was involved in the Amoco Cadiz disaster. They just didn't have the money to pay for the damage, so they walked away.
That's because Exxon and the Coast Guard use two different counting systems. For example, if the beach is, say, 10 miles long and only 5 miles is covered by oil, Exxon adds 5 miles to its column of oiled beaches. But the Coast Guard says that 10 miles of beach have been oiled. So when Exxon treats that beach, the company gets credit for all 10 miles. That's why it's possible for Exxon to say that 730 miles have been oiled and they've already completed treatment on 700 miles of beach. That's also why the Coast Guard estimates that only a third of the job has been done. Coast Guard Admiral Robbins thinks that Exxon's estimate of the miles of beaches filed by oil is way too low.
I ask for the latest information that we have on the miles impacted, and that came out to be 1,081.4. I think that number is low. That will probably grow, I'm guessing, but another 300 miles when all of the information is in.
Now, everybody managing the oil spill understands this numbers game. It's just the public that's confused. But to set the record straight, as of July 31st, Exxon says they've treated 197 miles of beach in Prince William Sound and another 508 miles in the Gulf of Alaska. However, this latter number has the state number crunchers shaking their heads. Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Dennis Kelso can't figure out why the number of treated beaches in the Gulf of Alaska is so large.
The only way that we could explain it was to assume that areas that had been assessed, but which may not themselves have been oiled, but which were in this or did not require gross contamination removal at this initial phase, those stretches of shoreline nevertheless were included when Exxon listed what it was that it had accomplished in the way of miles covered. And I'm not suggesting any kind of sleazy dealing here. I just mean that there's different ways of counting this, and that was the only way we could account for such a large amount of mileage.
All parties agree that the real job isn't moving numbers on pieces of paper, but getting the oil off the beaches. In Anchorage, this is Johanna York.
Exxon says the previous test on Disk Island was successful and corrects it should be allowed to be used widely. But state and federal officials say the Disk Island test did not prove conclusively that corrects it is a more effective cleaning treatment than normal wash methods. Exxon also insists that demands for lab tests on specific marine life local to the area are not necessary, but state and federal agencies disagree. Because of the necessity to clean the toxic crude oil off the beaches before it solidifies any further, an agreement has been reached to allow the use of Corexit while waiting for chronic effect test results, closely comparing the chemical cleaner to normal wash, and collecting sediment and water samples for further testing. If at any time during the application of Corexit, either toxicity information from the labs or visual observations in the field raise flags of concern, the federal on-scene coordinator can halt the use of the new chemical. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley. After 4 months of helping with the Exxon Valdez oil spill cleanup, the Russian skimmer Vyatigubsky left Port Valdez for the last time Saturday night to head for home. But first, it stopped to shop. Saying they were personal or private purchases, Russian sailor Alek Kalunnikov confirmed that 7 used trucks and cars were purchased in Valdez and hoisted aboard for transport back to Russia. According to Kalunnikov, the captain bought himself a used Peugeot. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
The Fish and Wildlife Service found 2 neatly covered graves at Powali Bay. One grave contained close to 200 birds, the other held 75. Jay Ballinger of the Fish and Wildlife Service says he has no idea who buried the birds.
You know, there was a lot of supposition and hypothesizing on how that may have happened. You know, I don't know there's any way that we can figure out how it happened. I do know that in the beginning, at least on the Barrens, there were people out there working those beaches that weren't equipped to take birds back, especially like helicopter crews. And they did, once that I know of, it was reported in a conference call in the Barrens, you know, do that sort of thing in the drift line, trying to get them out of the food chain.
In that instance, the crew clearly marked the grave with surveying tape so the carcasses could be picked up later. The graves at Powali Bay were not marked. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Nancy Hillstrand, who operates a holding facility for 99 otters not far from Homer in Jackaloff Bay, says many animals are recovered and ready to return to the wild. In fact, things are getting a little jumpy at times out in the pens.
We
we've also had a number of rogue males that come in, and these animals mate with our females, and they beat the tar out of the males.
The Fish and Wildlife Service has been moving very deliberately with its release strategy. Spokesman Bruce Batten says in part that's because there have been differences of opinion with the state about how it ought to be handled, and in part it's because they want to be sure they're doing the right thing.
What we want to do most importantly is to get an idea of what happens to the otters after they're released, and have an idea of what will happen to otters with different backgrounds. We've determined that to get a statistically valid sample of the fate of these otters, we need to be able to keep track of 45 of them. As of this time, we've implanted 33 otters, and 21 of those have been released.
But Hillstrand says the Fish and Wildlife Service already knows what's happening to the otters. Some find new habitat, but some go back to where they came from. They know human contact is not good for wild otters, and in her facility, they've taken great pains to keep their otters wild.
These animals have already gone through such hell already that I just feel as though it's enough of a sample to find out what we need to find out. We've had a lot of studies down in California and in the Sound already, and we just want to be assured that everyone is listening to the other things that have happened, you know, the other experiments that have happened first, so we're not just doubling up on some of these other experiments that they're trying to do right now.
Hillstrand says under Fish and Wildlife Service direction, a dozen of her otters will have to be repeatedly drugged for blood sampling and again for implanting the transmitters. With a little more thought, she says, at least the handling could be kept to a minimum. She questions whether anything of worth will be learned. Batten says they need to know more to be sure they're doing their releases in the best way, but also to know how successful the entire otter rescue program has been.
What's going to happen to them in 3 months, 6 months, a year, or even 2 years from now? Will they be healthy enough after having gone through the trauma of exposure to oil, or even just the trauma of capture and being saved, so to speak? Are they healthy enough to live normal, long, and healthy lives? But these are the questions we don't have answers to.
But Nancy Hillstrand says she's not sure anybody is listening to what they've already learned, or to the voice of their own hearts. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
Dr. John French is a biochemist at the University of Alaska's Fisheries Industrial Technology Center in Kodiak. French just returned from a conference in Seattle last week on the effects of an oil spill on the health of humans and other animal life. French says not enough information has been compiled yet, and he says even after studying earlier spills, it is still too early to say exactly what could happen to wildlife in the long term. French says some extremely toxic compounds can accumulate and be passed on from one organism to another. Bioaccumulation of substances like chlorinated dioxins, DDT, and PCBs is known to be very high. However, aromatic hydrocarbons present in crude oil have a relatively low bioaccumulation factor.
We probably don't have to worry to a large extent about magnification up the food chain. And in many cases, in terms of subsistence use, we're talking about direct consumption of the organism, be it a shellfish or a fish that's directly exposed to the water. So we're not going to have to worry about these types of problems that we see with the chlorinated pollutants that we do need to worry about and have shut down fisheries in areas like Michigan and so forth.
Several components in crude oil may have toxic and mutagenetic effects. Fish have suffered fin erosion and tumor formation from toxic components in previous studies, and French admits low levels of toxic compounds may still be present in weathered crude, but it is still uncertain how much is harmful and what the effects may be.
So the question becomes one, not one of not toxicity, but one of acceptable risk. And I think that's one we all need to stop hiding from, because we can't simply go out and tell the public that something that has identified toxins in it is not toxic. We need to be able to try to communicate what the risks are so that the public can make a reasonable approximation of what an acceptable risk is. These constituents that are identified as toxic in the weathered crude are below the levels that are considered to be a problem by standard EPA and FDA guidelines. So in that sense, I would have to agree with the people that have said they do not currently present a major concern. But I will not say that they're not toxic.
French believes subsistence food will be safe to eat if taken from areas free from major hits of oil.
My best guess, and I'm admitting it's a guess, is that the fish are, as long as they don't, you know, there's no visible contamination, there's no smell, my best guess is that the fish are acceptable to eat. I've collected subsistence fish this summer. I plan to eat them.
That's Dr. John French of the Fisheries Industrial Technology Center in Kodiak. I'm Matt Miller.
Exxon will be here in the spring. They will do what the Coast Guard tells them to do. The Coast Guard will not do that unilaterally without consultation with the state, and neither will we impose something on them that's patently unreasonable. Now, exactly what all that means, we'll have to wait until we see the situation.
The DEC permit says continuous measurement of emissions are necessary to guarantee proper operation and combustion efficiency. But the Sealy barge incinerator doesn't have the right instruments for continuous reading, so Exxon is suggesting a temporary change in the permit to allow manual readings once an hour. Exxon calls the changes to the permit non-critical instrumentation. Exxon and Sealy waived their 5-day permit review period in order to have the permits issued Monday. Now they want the changes so that the incinerator can start up today. As of late last night, there was no action on the request by DEC. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
If they're close to a contaminated area, will they go into it? If they go into it, what will happen to them? Has the oil lost toxicity that it had before, which perhaps would have killed them or given them health problems, and now won't? These are the kind of questions that we have that we hope to be able to answer.
Is it just a matter of people not looking deep enough and seeing the answer right before them and not wanting to admit that this is, you know, that they have the answer already?
They're not demobilizing. They're phasing into a winter operation where they're going to do surveys. We're going to do surveys. We're going to do overflights. We're going to have people here all winter long. And as we move into the spring where weather allows us to do something, we're going to know what needs to be done through these surveys. And what the Coast Guard thinks needs to be done, Exxon will be here and will do.
Will they, number one, swim back to the areas where they were originally recovered, in which case they might not be safe areas to go in? And number two, on a longer term basis, what's going to happen to them in 3 months, 6 months, a year, or even 2 years from now?
Stress on the animal is just, it is really a lot more than I feel the animal should go through, especially considering what the animal has already gone through due to the oil spill.
When Dan Lawn was relieved of his supervisor's duties on August 1st with 1 day's notice, Division Director Larry Dietrich said it was hopefully a positive move to give Lawn time to concentrate on oil spill contingency plans. But in a memo written 2 months earlier, Dietrich wrote that Lawn was to be taken off the job because of his, quote, lack of objectivity and professional manner in regulating the oil industry. The memo also states that Lawn was overworked. The pipeline company had labeled Lawn a troublemaker some time ago and was clearly unhappy with the 7-year veteran's aggressive style. Dietrich denied being pressured by the oil industry to remove Lawn. The Alaska Public Employees Association has filed a grievance charging that Lawn was demoted without due process or just cause. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
At Tuesday's multi-agency briefing with Admirals Yost and Robbins, Borough Mayor Jerome Selby asked them why geotextiles can't be used. Selby said the remainder of August and early September are all we've got left, and we want to get the stuff out of our lives as much as possible. Geotextiles seem to be the most effective means to maximize oil cleanup efforts. When Yost and Robbins questioned Exxon representative Wayne Purdom about the use of geotextiles, Purdom said tests didn't show them to be as effective as other means already in use. Purdom said legal concerns also remain. But in spite of Exxon's reluctance, Robbins said he's heard so much about geotextiles he wants to use them. As far as determining their effectiveness, Robbins said, let's try it and put it to bed once and for all. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
The move to get Dan Lawn out of the Valdez supervisor's job was apparently triggered by a run-in between Lawn and an Exxon security guard in May. The Alyeska Pipeline Service Company had been complaining about Lawn for years. And in a memo dated May 31st, DEC Environmental Quality Director Larry Dietrich decided it was necessary to put an end to Lawn's scraps with the oil industry. He wrote, quote, "Mr. Lawn's lack of objectivity and professional manner towards those we regulate seriously interferes with his ability to constructively perform his duties." Dietrich also believed that Lawn was suffering from stress due to his nearly round-the-clock work schedule following the spill. The version of the memo released by DEC late yesterday was sanitized to delete what DEC said were references to other employees. Lawn was abruptly relieved of most of his duties on August 1st. Dietrich denied taking action because of pressure from the oil industry. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Exxon referred to the requirements as non-critical instrumentation and asked DEC to allow hourly readings of emissions since the Sealy barge incinerator didn't have the proper equipment for continuous monitoring. DEC said no. Exxon scrambled to obtain what was necessary and reports that, weather permitting, it should be installed today, thus allowing for startup. DEC says state monitors will be present for the initial burning and will be conducting visual checks of the Sealy barge incinerator on a regular basis. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
They won't stop it slower, so it's up to you. If we're gonna have a meeting, we've gotta shut the pipeline down. Don't be dead, duck, quack, quack. Don't be.
The group Earth First has done things in the past, like driving spikes into trees to sabotage timber cutting and breaking into meetings. But this week, they broke into song, as two stories above, members of the group, wearing climbing gear, had scaled the pedestrian sky bridge to hang a splotchy black and white banner reading, "Big Oil, Death of the Future." Since the March 24th oil spill, these sort of things have become almost predictable. Like other displays at Exxon headquarters, the calls were made, the press all showed up, the cops came to the pipeline headquarters and arrested the two banner hangers. Meanwhile, the small crowd this time was chanting, "Arrest the real criminals, Big Oil kills." Executives who came out of the Alyeska offices made no official comments, although some could be overheard making jokes about the building climber's windbreaker and nylon climbing rope, all made from petroleum products. But organizer Michael Robinson says this display was to do more than spout rhetoric. It's to put the oil companies on notice that they're no longer wanted. Robinson handed out a list of demands that include canceling offshore oil leases, banning oil exploration in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and nothing less than plugging all the wells now in production on the North Slope and dismantling the Alyeska pipeline.
Obviously, we don't have the power to close it down ourselves. But we think a lot of Alaskans are starting to demand that, and we think that this can be the beginning of a movement that will demand no more destruction of Alaskan wilderness on the hands of the oil industry.
While state officials and the oil industry may not rush to meet the group's goals, Robinson and others say they're serious, and they say there are serious alternatives to big oil.
Sustainable fisheries, sustainable forestry, and sustainable lifestyles in general that include a lot less dependence throughout the world and the United States and Alaska on petroleum products, more dependence on a healthy environment that can provide the need for life's existence.
Michael Robinson and other members of the environmental group Earth First outside Alyeska Pipeline headquarters. In Anchorage, I'm Robert Hawk.
It don't matter if they spend $1 trillion, we're not going to be dead ducks. It don't matter if they spend $1 trillion.
Last week, one of Dan Lawn's superiors, Division Director Larry Dietrich, said Lawn was being reassigned to study oil spill plans. For the past 7 years, Lawn had been helping review those plans, as well as going head-to-head with Alyeska officials in cleanup drills and in monitoring the terminal's ballast water treatment facility. This job action, apparently taken with only one day's notice to Lawn, effectively stripped all his duties except the plan reviews. This week, an internal DEC memo written by Dietrich offers other reasons for Lawn's removal. The memo was apparently triggered by an altercation between Lawn and an Exxon security guard in May, which reportedly involved a dispute over access to the Exxon building in Valdez. In the memo, dated May 31st, Dietrich writes, "The incident between Dan Lawn and the Exxon security guard has made it necessary to take definitive action to prevent a recurrence, relieve the stress on this employee, and reestablish a leadership role for the Valdez District Office. The memo adds that this was not an isolated incident, although details of other alleged incidents are blacked out in the memo. That memo was sanitized by DEC personnel officials to protect the privacy rights of other DEC employees. Lawn granted permission for the memo to be made public. In the memo, Dietrich leaves little doubt that one of the reasons he wanted Lawn out of the supervisor's job was his hard-driving, combative style of making sure Alyeska complied with state pollution laws. Dietrich wrote that, quote, Mr. Lawn's lack of objectivity and professional manner towards those we regulate seriously interferes with his ability to constructively perform his duties. The memo also describes Lawn as stressed and overworked. Lawn's union has filed a grievance over the job action, so officials, including Lawn himself, are reluctant to discuss the case. Three of Dan Lawn's bosses, Dietrich, Bill Lamoureux, and Bruce Erickson, were not at work, according to the DEC Thursday. But suggestions that Dietrich was caving in to pressure from the oil industry to get rid of a longtime thorn in its side are categorically denied by several sources who knew Dietrich. And even some of the harshest critics of this move say they don't believe Dietrich was trying to do the oil industry a favor. But so far, there's been little offered in the way of alternative explanations. A review of Lawn's performance evaluations, again with Lawn's permission, offers little evidence for his removal. Every single evaluation rates Lawn's effectiveness from acceptable to outstanding. And if anything, his aggressive style was considered an asset in the chronically understaffed Valdez office. Here are a few comments from Lawn's supervisors over the years. Dan has shouldered the entire oil tanker inspection and cleanup monitoring program and the state's role in the Valdez terminal operations. Dan's functioning in crisis situations makes him worth double his salary. His aggressive nature significantly shortens the overall time from problem identification to solution. For this, Dan must be commended. Lawn's approach to the ballast water problem has brought about amazing results. On the negative side, Lawn's supervisors noted continuing tensions between Lawn and Alyeska officials, his reluctance to follow regulations to the letter if he thought he had a better solution, and his, quote, difficulty in accepting supervisions and directions. Overall, a very positive portrait as far as it goes, but inexplicably, Lawn's evaluations stop after 1987. His 1988 evaluation was due a year and a half ago, and another evaluation was due this past February. Also unexplained is why Lawn wasn't removed on June 5th, as Dietrich ordered in the May 31st memo, but remained in place until August 1st. These questions may be answered as Lawn's appeal of his removal goes forward. But a larger question remains. Even if this move reflects nothing more than an internal DEC dispute, will Dan Lawn's sudden demotion tarnish the credibility of one of the state's star witnesses when Alaska takes on Exxon and Alyeska in a multi-million dollar court battle over the Exxon Valdez oil spill? For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
DEC's press release says, we believe we are requiring appropriate safeguards to protect Alaskans' health and environment. And already this week, DEC has held firm in refusing to change those requirements. Three incinerator permits were issued, and the most restrictive is the one for the Sealy Barge. According to Jeff Mock, acting director for DEC's environmental quality, the primary difference is in the materials to be burned.
The Sealy incinerator is not permitted to burn the chlorinated plastics, and they're going to be also burning wood and other vegetation that we don't expect to contain that the salt water primarily. The concern there is the formation of dioxins and so forth.
Although currently there are no state or federal laws governing dioxins and furans, DEC has set permit limits equal to what the EPA is proposing for incinerators burning municipal garbage. Mock says it's difficult to test specifically for those emissions, but there are indicators.
For instance, the continuous monitoring for carbon monoxide, to use that as an indicator of overall combustion efficiency.
Continuous measurements proved to be an initial problem for the Sealy Barge because it didn't have the proper instruments to do that. DEC refused to allow startup without continuous monitoring, and Exxon Waste Manager Rob Dragnich says the necessary equipment is being installed.
Number of different instruments that not only allow the operators to see what's going on, but also provide permanent records of the process conditions that allows Exxon or the Department of Environmental Conservation or Sealy as well to go back and look to see, you know, were things being run in the manner that they should have been? Were the necessary temperatures being maintained in the combustion chamber? Was the heat exchanger operating properly? The critical ones are recorded continuously. The less critical are also recorded continuously, and then there are other ones that are recorded on an hourly basis.
The two most critical are combustion efficiency and combustion temperature. And in Seeley's case, combustion temperature requirements are a second area where its permit differs from those issued to the other incinerator operations, according to DEC's Jeff Mock.
The Seeley incinerator is required to maintain a higher minimum temperature because it is a single chamber incinerator, while the rotary kilns have got dual chambers. And they typically have a higher temperature in the second chamber, primarily to minimize or avoid the creation of dioxins and other compounds that you don't want.
The Seeley permit requires that the incinerator reach 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit prior to waste material being burned. Dragnet says Exxon thinks the barge can operate under that condition, but until the operation is actually started to see how the unit performs, they don't know for sure.
That temperature may not be necessary. They have a very conservative temperature of 1,700 degrees required. We know the unit can get up to 1,500 or a little greater, and that is generally considered adequate by the experts we've talked to prevent formation of dioxin, so it's a conservative permit from that perspective.
Dragnet says Seeley and Exxon believe they've developed a method to increase the temperature so that they won't have to address the issue with DEC in terms of looking for any sort of exemption or waiver. The incinerator permits allow for 35 days of startup and testing, and source testing won't be conducted for 2 to 3 weeks. But DEC's Bob Canone, project coordinator for plans and permitting, says from day one to the time of the source test, DEC will be conducting visual emissions monitoring and facility inspections.
We're going to try to do it frequently. I can't tell you at this point in time how often that's going to be, but we're going to try to have somebody out there on a regular basis.
Canone says DEC also plans to be on the Seeley barge for startup, which Exxon was hoping would happen today. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
At first glance, Mars Cove looks like a piece of pristine wilderness. It's hard to see any oil in the water, and from the air, the beaches look clean. That perception disappears immediately once you set foot on the ground. There are 5 small beaches in the cove, and they're all covered with oil. The mucky brown substance clings to everything. It covers large rocks, tiny pine needles, and is embedded in the cliffs that surround the beach. The 15 volunteers work with the tides. When it's out, they hit the beaches and begin systematically doing the work. With small hand trawls and brushes, the volunteers scrape away at the oil. It's slow work, and progress is defined in square feet, not miles. But the attitude is positive. Keena Hollett came from Atlanta to help out on the oil spill. Sitting on a beach in Mars Cove in a light but cold rain, she was busy scraping away at the oil-covered rocks. She said the condition of the beach was much worse than she imagined it would be.
Yeah, being from Georgia, I don't have the latest word on what's happening in Alaska like the rest of the nation. We really get it third hand and very well diluted and PR'd and everything, I think. So I was amazed, saddened, and really disgusted by this is filth. I mean, it's got to be cleaned. And oil, it's amazing. It's really difficult to get it off. And it's not going to hose away, and you can't just let nature try to fight it itself. We need to come and give it a hand and clean it really rock by rock. And I wish everyone could do this, or just see it for a little while, and then they would understand, because it's there. It's so much worse than I ever thought it would be.
The volunteers are using a different strategy than Exxon has employed over the summer. Rather than bag up the contaminated material and ship it out to dump sites, they plan to run the rocks through a gravel washing machine and then put the rocks back on the beach. What constitutes a clean beach is being debated right now by Exxon, the Coast Guard, and the state. Volunteer organizer Ben Levine says the beach will never be restored to its original condition. The goal of the volunteer group is to clean it to a point where people can enjoy the beach without being worried about oil.
This is a state park where we are. You know, people can come in here and kayak or hike and recreate as you do in state parks. And if you want to sit down on a beach and have your picnic lunch off of your kayak, you want to be able to sit there and not be worried about really what you're sitting in. Or if a bird lands on it, their feet don't get oiled or the feathers. An otter can drag themselves up on the beach and go into the forest, you know, land otter. Restore it to an acceptable level where you're not risking re-oiling and life can continue more or less as normal.
Attaining that goal is going to take a lot of hard work. The volunteers recently received the go-ahead from the Coast Guard to use the gravel washing machines, and it's hoped that will speed up the cleaning process, but a lot of work will still have to be done by hand. Eric Larson of Anchorage was working on a cliff that bordered Mars Cove. The oil had splashed up into the cracks of the rock wall, and he was busy trying to scrape it out. The work was slow and tedious, but he went about it in a steady, determined manner.
When we first got on the beach, it was this beach yesterday, it hadn't, nothing had been done to it, so there was no treatment, no spraying, nothing on it. It was just the way it was after the oil hit it. And I started to cry, and I had to go over. You just start to think of the magnitude of this thing, that I'm looking at 1 square foot here, scraping off moose, 1 square foot here, and there's 700 miles of this stuff. And the immensity of it and the severity of it just sort of soaked into me, and just had to think about it for a while. It was very sad.
The Exxon crews are scheduled to begin shutting down cleanup operations. Company officials are sticking to plans to be off the beach by September 15th. The volunteers say they will remain in Mars Cove past September and stay as long as weather permits and work can be done. There's mutual respect between the Exxon crews and the volunteers. In fact, some of the volunteers worked for Exxon subcontractor Vico earlier this summer. Former resident Jim Heinsohn said everyone is interested in one thing: cleaning up the oil.
Any of these beach workers out here, whether they're Vico or ours, you know, I think they're all heroes because they're all sacrificing their health to change it. So, you know, I'm impressed. Anybody who's been on the beach is okay in my book.
I'm Joe Gallagher.
The Magnuson Act, which asserts U.S. jurisdiction over fisheries out to 200 miles at sea, is up for reauthorization this year, and the House Committee has already had hearings about it in Washington, where many who fish in Alaska waters come from. There, they were told that the makeup of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, which makes the recommendations for who fishes where, ought to be changed, because it now has too many Alaskans on it. They're sure to hear a different tune here. They'll also probably hear about foreign drift nets and about salmon interception. Governor Cooper will ask them to strengthen the language that lays claim to fish from U.S. waters. The continuing pressure for more official observation of fishing activities will come to the surface, and the debate over how it ought to be paid for. One trawling group in Washington says it's ready to pay itself. And waste will be talked about, whether fisheries can be managed in the least harmful way when some fishing methods clearly have more bycatches and do more bottom damage than others. And many operations are continuing to invest in new equipment, enough to catch far more fish than sensible management will ever allow. The hearing will go on all day at the Anchorage Library. The committee will then move on to Ketchikan and Kodiak. For APRN in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel. There are 9 of them in all, 5 Democrats, including Subcommittee Chairman Gary Studs, and 4 Republicans, including Don Young. They've been in Cordoba and Valdez inspecting the spill and hearing from officials such as Exxon President Bill Stevens, who assured them the company intends to be back on the spill next spring if it's needed. In Anchorage, they'll hear about such things as drift nets, salmon interception, and observer coverage. Along with the fuss about foreign fishing, there's also growing controversy about the domestic fleet, which is buying equipment like there's no tomorrow. It's the purpose of the Magnuson Act to assure that there is one. For APRN, I'm Steve Heimel.
We've sent a signal out to industry. It's not going to be business as usual. It's going to be a lot stricter standards. We intend to enforce those. We found their contingency plan to be adequate, the equipment to be the best we've ever seen, the best also the contingency plan we've ever had. And the manpower and the capability was extremely qualified people.
You just start to think of the magnitude of this thing, that I'm looking at 1 square foot here, scraping off moose, 1 square foot here, and there's 700 miles of this stuff.
But I do think that the Valdez has made the situation more difficult and has raised public concern. And the public has every right to expect that if the federal government and industry is going to go out in their marine environment, that they go and not do things that harm their environment. And in the outer continental shelf, that's our territory, and that's what our job is to do, to provide that assurance and provide that protection.
You can't just let nature try to fight it itself. We need to come and give it a hand and clean it really rock by rock.
Larry Dietrich has come under fire for pulling DEC's top Alyeska investigator off the job 4 months after the nation's worst oil spill. But in an interview Friday, Dietrich said he limited 7-year veteran supervisor Dan Lawn to reviewing oil spill contingency plans, in part because he feels DEC needs a more professional approach to regulating Alyeska. In a May 31st memo released this week, Dietrich wrote that Dan Lawn had shown a lack of objectivity and professional manner in his dealings with the pipeline company. When pressed for an explanation of professional manner, Dietrich suggested that an environmental watchdog has to do more than just complain about violations. He said, quote, complaining just doesn't do it. We're the enforcer. And while I have great respect for Dan's expertise, if we can't enforce our standards, we're not doing our job. One example Dietrich used was Alyeska's waste gas incinerators. He said, steam controls were missing, plumbing is missing, they haven't been running right for many years. We should have been taking steps to stop that. Dietrich was reluctant to give further examples, noting that Lon is fighting through an employee grievance to get his supervisor's job back. There is one reference to this subject in Lon's performance evaluation from 1986. Supervisor Bruce Erickson wrote that Lon showed some hesitancy in initiating enforcement actions, due either to not understanding the position of management or a general feeling of insecurity in his position. Lon disagreed with that evaluation, but no rebuttal was found in his personnel file. Overall, Dan Lawn has never been rated below acceptable on overall effectiveness or performance. Those documents do not tell the whole story, however. DEC's records show no evaluations at all for Lawn for the past 2 years. Dietrich was at a loss to explain that, saying that perhaps the supervisor was late getting them done. APEA Representative Bob Watts said labor relations law says the lack of an evaluation must be construed as an acceptable rating. Whether DEC will be able to substantiate its claim that Lawn was weak on enforcement is not clear. Also not clear is who is heading up the state's monitoring of Alyeska now that Lawn is busy with spill plans. The man technically in charge is Bruce Erickson, who works in Anchorage and is responsible for several districts besides Prince William Sound. In a memo dated August 3rd, Erickson wrote that he would make every effort to be in the office at least one day a week, and that he would need the Valdez staff's patience and cooperation in the coming months while he learns the fine points of this office. DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso said Friday that he can't discuss details of the Lawn case now under a grievance, but he wanted to make it clear that he was satisfied Dietrich's decision was strictly an internal management change that was part of an overall program to toughen the Valdez office, not weaken it. Kelso added that he did consider the possibility that the move would look bad, but he decided not to let outside considerations get in the way of Dietrich's plan to strengthen the South Central region and the Valdez office. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
The 95 otters at Little Jackaloff Bay came from otter cleaning facilities at Seward and Valdez. Most of the otters were oiled, but they've been treated and are well on the road to recovery. Munching on mussels and crab while they float in their pens, the otters seem to be in excellent health. But some of the workers fear the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service may be threatening the well-being of the otters. The service is implanting radio transmitters into a dozen of the animals for tracking purposes. Blood samples from the otters were required before the implant surgery, and one of the otters died this week after blood was taken. It was the first otter to die at the center,
and the death has increased opposition to the implant program. Director Nancy Hillstrand says the otters have already been through enough stress and shouldn't be subjected to any more. Hillstrand says she hasn't been convinced that the studies being done are worthwhile.
I am questioning the viability of their study and exactly why they're doing it, what kind of data they're going to get, is it going to be conclusive, and what, once they do get the data, how are they going to use it, or what is the main reason for it? Is it for getting money, or for, you know, is it going to help the otter at all? And these questions have not been answered to me by the Fish and Wildlife Service, so I'm questioning a lot of some of the things that they're doing.
Thursday, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officials were at the Jackaloff Otter Center to try and answer some of the questions about the implant program. They told the staff that the 12 otters that are implanted with the radio transmitters will be released in Prince William Sound. Service spokesman Gary Sonneville said 21 otters from Valdez have already undergone the operation and have been released. He said the agency also plans to implant transmitters on 100 wild otters. Their movements and behavior will be compared with the rehabilitated animals. Sonneville explained how the transmitters, which are the size of a cigarette package, are hooked up to the otters.
The transmitters are surgically implanted into the abdomen of the otter. A small incision is made, the transmitter is inserted, and then the otter is sutured back up. The otter is administered antibiotics, and we go through a brief holding period to make sure that the otters are doing fine and that healing is proceeding. If by chance we have an otter that takes longer to heal, then that otter will not be released in the wild until they have fully healed up.
Sonneville said a lot of money has been spent on the otter rehabilitation program, and the Fish and Wildlife Service needs to know if the project was successful. He said the only way to determine that is to track the otters for a long period of time. Tracking by boat or plane is difficult, especially in the winter months, and the only workable method from the agency's viewpoint is radio transmission.
We're trying to get a feel for the success of the rehabilitation process. One of the primary concerns we have is the animals have gone through the process, they've been cleaned up, they're doing well here at the centers. Will they survive the winter? Will they survive over a year? And that's a question that we can only answer if we can track individual animals and follow them for that length of time period. Presently, the program is to track these animals for between 2 and 3 years. The transmitters they will be fitted with are 1,000-day in duration.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officials weren't successful in convincing the staff at the Otter Center that the implant program was a good idea. The meeting went on for a number of hours, and at one point, after being asked some tough questions, Fish and Wildlife's Keith Behoff told Nancy Hillstrand that it didn't matter what her opinion was. There were experts hired to make the decisions, and that was the advice he was going to follow. The implant operations were scheduled to begin Friday and be completed by the weekend. Still, Nancy Hillstrand is holding out hope something can be done to halt the process.
I really don't know what is going to happen. I'm so tired. I'm tired of fighting bureaucracy and fighting against animal researchers. And I'm really at the end of the, kind of at the end of my rope here, because it's like, what do you do? How much of a stand do you take? Well, I hope that people will call their congressman and call whoever they think they can call. Call Fish and Wildlife Service, whoever they think is important enough to tell what is going on here. And if they do agree that it should not be done, maybe they can help us to stop it legally.
The otters in Little Jackaloff Bay that aren't implanted with radio transmitters are scheduled to be released August 17th. But at this point, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service hasn't been able to find a location along the Kenai Peninsula coast where the otters would be safe from oil. Reporting from Homer, I'm Joe Gallagher.
After a four-hour meeting that reviewed lab toxicity reports and field verifications of effectiveness, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation voted against the use of Exxon's new chemical, Corexit. Both the EPA and the DEC hold the position that Exxon did not prove that the efficiency of Corexit is greater than that of other cleaning treatments. Plus, the state recognizes an element of risk to the environment that it was unwilling to accept. But Corexit is not necessarily dead. Even without a favorable recommendation from DNR, the federal on-scene coordinator still can call a meeting of the regional resource team for approval. EPA and DEC have representatives on that panel and would have to vote again. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.